From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
With about 7.5 months remaining before the first presidential primary takes place, that being the Iowa caucus on February 3rd, what passes for the presidential campaign appears to be a cacophony of divergent trends and rather murky aims. To try to parse through all of this, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero, the political science professor who is also director of the Philadelphia Saturday Free School. We spoke with him via Skype from Philadelphia Wednesday. Well, Professor Montero, some interesting developments over the past couple weeks from the appointment, apparently, of Rand Paul as a special envoy to Iran. Quite a flip from having the psychos that have been the point person, you know, for several administrations, really. I would say going back to Carter, actually. And that's one. We've got President Trump's rally in North Carolina, mobbed, and his taking on the so-called Gang of Four, the inter-party wrangling that's going on with the right wing of the right wing party. It's like so hard to say that there's a left wing. The four that are alleged to be the left wing, the Gang of Four, and the dynamics with the speaker and everybody else, and then people choosing up sides at New York Times. So you want to kind of walk us through some of this stuff and help us understand what the hell's going on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's good to be with you, Don.
Same.
Listen, man, the way I look at things is that the 1,000-pound elephant in the canoe is the international situation. Mm. In other words, the rush to get Trump out of the presidency, which began, of course, the day after he was elected, is all about how the United States will be positioned where Asia is rising, where Europe is in disarray, and where the U.S. economy, especially the profits of the largest banks, financial institutions, and hedge funds, and the positioning of the dollar in the global economy will all depend upon how the United States going forward will stand vis-a-vis this rising new global economy and the rising power of Asia and what we used to call non-aligned or former colonial nations of the world, which includes, of course, South America and the Caribbean and Africa. Mm. So I think it's all mediated by international events. They are not spoken about in most of the presidential debates and most of what is written on the presidential campaign. But I think that's the beginning point. It mediates everything else, and it is central to understanding what is, in fact, a deepening conflict within the ruling class of the United States.
You know, what shows that? In other words, what shows that the supposed break between left and right, antagonism between the supposed left and right, with Trump representing the right and the Democrats and everybody else representing the left, is that the foreign policy position of the so-called left is not anti-imperialist, but rather, you know, aggressively imperialist. And what that means is, if you're going to hold yourself out to be a socialist, is that you're holding yourself out to be a socialist within the confines of a country whose production is not produced by the workers, but stolen from the workers and the rest of the world, which is not socialism. And so it's not a left. And so what you're having is like a family feud among the right, and it's being positioned as being a battle between the left and right.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. In a sense, what is the left is a very controlled and what we might call a bourgeois left. It's not a working class left. It's not a left of the poor, of the marginalized. It's a bourgeois left. So it's an identity politics left. It is a left without a program to solve the huge problems of poverty, unemployment, the displacement of labor because of automation and newer technologies, the greater concentration of wealth, the concentration of a few internet and social media giants over, you know, all of this technology. So it is not a working class left. It is left only from the standpoint of its position vis-a-vis traditional liberalism within the Democratic Party and traditional more or less conservative and right-wing positions within the Republican Party. But it is not a left in the sense of a radical left. It is a bourgeois left. And I don't think we should get those things confused. And for that reason, its concerns seldom go beyond the so-called borders of the United States. The only borders that they're really interested in is the southern border, and they've weaponized the immigration question for political purposes, but they're not really concerned with the world and what is emerging in world events. So it's not considered a serious left. It's socialist only by self-definition, and at best, it is some kind of New Deal a la Franklin Roosevelt, but that's it. That's the way I would put it.
I mean, it's imperial politics. The concessions that were made to in the imperialist countries in Britain and France and, you know, all of them to their workers and starting, you know, in the 17th century or whatever, as they started bringing home the gold from around the world, were funded. You know, it's like here, okay, we've stolen everything from everybody in our country. Now we just stole like $1 trillion here. You guys can have $10.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And so, mm-hmm. you know, suddenly everybody's saying, wow, we have socialism now.
Yeah.
You know, but nobody's looking at the nature of the economy and their role. You know, they still stand in relation to the means of production in exactly the same place they stood. We know absent imperialism, but now they get a few pieces of coin that fall off the top of the pile while they're carrying it from the boat to the bank.
Yeah. I think I would agree with that. And that's why, in some ways, it can be considered dangerous to play this game of radicalism and radical politics, because it can have the effect of turning off the working class to socialism or a radical reorganization of the domestic economy or to questions of peace and peaceful coexistence and so on. I think that's the effect of it. If you're talking about the squad or the Gang of Four, I would say that they're pretty much a disaster. Most people, even in the Democratic Party, see it that way, a political disaster, I'll put it that way. If the Democratic Party is anti-Trump, then the Gang of Four, breaks the coalition of the anti-Trump forces, right, at least if one is interested in winning the 2020 election. I think they make it very difficult, if not impossible, to win.
I mean, why, for example, would they not articulate a foreign policy in opposition to the one that's been conducted, say, since 1945, mm-hmm. actual socialists, even, you know, the Trotskyites and every mm-hmm. kind of factional group you can find, with some exceptions, mm-hmm. would all say, okay, well, you know, we're in favor of a program where the United States closes most of the 800 military bases around the world, brings the Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force home, tamps it way down so we can fight a defensive war and no more, you know, possibility in terms of just weaponry for global conflict, and spend that money on infrastructure and on the basic needs of the people. That would be a very popular program. And, mm-hmm. by the way, they'd be stealing some of Trump's thunder because he essentially ran on that. And they could then have a standing to say, you promised this, but the way you're going about it isn't the way to do it. That can only happen with socialism, for example, mm-hmm. as one mm-hmm. argument. But whatever. And challenge on a policy level the path to this thing that everybody knows people want and almost no one wants to say out loud.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I mean, you know, at least the position of Tulsi Gabbard, the presidential candidate,
okay.
congresswoman from Hawaii.
Right.
But she, interestingly, doesn't fit into the Gang of Four's performance.
Right.
Because, you know, again, you know, she has a program, a policy, and a set of positions on international events that are connected to a domestic policy of demilitarization. So it right. seems to me that the Gang of Four are either useful idiots for the imperial mm-hmm. ruling class, right. or they're just idiots that don't know what they're doing.
Mm. No, I don't
and
know.
So they talk a lot, and in substance, say very little in terms of how to achieve all of these high-sounding things that they say they are for.
Yeah, I mean, those are possibilities. I also entertain strongly the possibility that they know precisely what they're doing, and what they're intending yeah. to do is to not is to occupy the space that actual socialists might instead be tempted mm-hmm. to try to occupy, and thereby have the constituents behind them fighting over stupid things that might actually be lining up behind actual socialists mm-hmm. and fighting over the wealth of the country.
Yeah. You take, for example, Trump is going to run in many ways to the right. He is going to mobilize, or at least he has begun, if we follow the or pay attention to the rally last night. He is going to run on not only keep America great, but put America first,
nice.
By which he is saying in substance, I think he's very conscious of this, that America is great because it has stood for certain values that if you critique those values, you're anti-American.
Yeah.
Now, that needs to be taken on. But you can't take it on by calling all of his voters or people that show up to his rallies racist.
Right.
Because, you know, we've just seen in the last few days that a lot of independents, in the face of the charge that they are all racist and so on, have moved to the Trump side,
right.
or at least moved away from the Democrats.
I know. I look at my TV set, and I want to scream out at these talking heads, hey, geniuses, on the one hand, you repeatedly say that the people of the United States are racist to the core, and then on the other hand, you say that we must win this election away from Trump, and the technique that you do is to start calling him a racist, and then you wonder why he goes up in the polls.
That's right. That's right. And then, like Hillary did, to call his voters or part of his voters disposable.
Right. Yep. Yep.
This year we're calling them racist.
Deplorable.
So yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, if that's the strategy, it is a strategy for defeat. They can never achieve what they say they're going to achieve. Right. And the other side of it is, if everything is racist, if every white person is a racist, then nothing is racism and no person is racist. I mean, everybody can't be a racist.
Right, it factors, in other words. Right.
Yeah.
You factor it out like we did in algebra in ninth grade.
Absolutely.
Yep.
So what they're claiming is an logical impossibility.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, they're taken in by all of their rhetoric of we're in the fascist moment.
Right.
Therefore, one of the first lines of defense in the fight against fascism is Antifa. Now, that's risky business, because nobody knows who Antifa is.
Right.
I think the way it looks now, and Thomas Friedman suggested this recently in a column in the New York Times, we're looking at Trump's reelection, and much bigger than in 2016.
I'd say it's quite possible, with a caveat that at this point in the 2016 election, Trump had 1%. There's obviously going to be an awful lot of movement all over the place. But I mean, looking at it in the historically typical terms, it looks like he's got a cakewalk unless, you know, they catch him with a sheep in the back seat of a Buick or something.
Yeah.
You know? And if the sheep's got his clothes on, then he'll be able to get out of that.
Yeah. And everything they try to pin on him, be it Epstein, be it Russia, or all of these other things, they don't have that much meaning for the people that vote for him.
Right, it's the same thing as before. It's the same, the people that we were talking to at the RNC that had been voting for years on abortion and gay marriage and stuff said they didn't care about that they needed a job, and he was the only one that was saying he would get one. Whether he was going to or not, we don't care. He's the only one saying he's going to get us one. And so now people still have some pretty serious material needs, and he's delivered to a lot of those people from last time. He actually has a track record, and that's a hard thing to dislodge. And by the way, with the incessant negative press from maybe 2015 until now, I saw a report this morning that says he now has a 50% favorability rating for the first time.
Yeah, the Rasmussen. The Rasmussen poll, which got it right in terms of the 2016 election and Trump winning. But here is the positive thing. If in a second term, and I'm only imagining because we don't know that he will get it.
Right.
But in a second term, if there is the continual movement towards peaceful coexistence with Russia, demilitarization of the Korean Peninsula, peaceful coexistence with North Korea, and on, and if, as might be possible now with Rand Paul being the emissary to the Iranian government, of course, Rand Paul is the opposite of Bolton, and is a non-interventionist, what I would call more interested in imperial retreat than intervention. He could be spectacularly successful in a imperial retreat, and hence making him, I think, the most peace-oriented president since John F. Kennedy. But that's not to be discussed, because the election from the side of the anti-Trump forces is to smear him, to tag his voters as racist and xenophobes, and as a rising fascist movement. It's just like Ocasio and others claiming that we got 12 years before climate change destroys the world. and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that kind of alarmism. The same thing with Trump. If we don't defeat him, we will have a fascist regime, and the only thing we can do then is run for the hills. You know, that's kind of the nonsense of a lot of leftist talking points at this time.
Yeah. You know, and there are so many contradictions. I mean, we start with the legacy of the last period, really, the political legacy of it. Let's say both the say 70s forward, and you know maybe the Ford Carter era forward, in Europe and in the United States and in Asia, you know, the post Vietnam, in other words, and then you know, Reagan, and then the post you know, collapse, quote unquote, of 1991 period, the Bush aggressive post 9/11 period. And so you have installed successfully in, across Europe, a good part of Asia, economic austerity for a generation or more, institutionalized practically. You know, just the ongoing military adventures around the world and the huge drain that that places on the economies and on in a number of other basic, you know, systems. And a political, you know, like the electoral politics that has, you know, a left and a right, quote unquote, that are okay with all of that. That, you know, they'll tweak maybe this program or that program, but it's almost like they have a common program except for abortion or gay marriage or whatever. In other words, things that are not class issues, things that are not matters of war and peace, things that have nothing to do with economics, things that are, in essence, I mean, they're more than window dressing, but against the, you know, the institutions of the society, window dressing.
Well, here is where the Democrats under Hillary, and it seems like a good part of them going forward, are really messing up big time. You know, they've kind of taken the tactics of the conservative right from the 1980s and 90s, but now they apply to the left. They're going to wage cultural war rather than struggle about essential matters.
Right, exactly.
Class war. Class matters. Right. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. You know, so cultural wars from the left are identity politics. Right. And, you know, it's a losing proposition. In a time of real crisis, and you know, the economic numbers do not reflect the deep economic crisis of all working people, including the white working class, but all working people. You know, the numbers show that 50% of the working class are living from day to day and are either in poverty or close to it. And if you take African Americans, it could go as high as 75% either in or near to poverty, you know. And this is not, it has no, these numbers do not respect how much education you have or whatever, because you got PhDs who can't get permanent jobs and who are living from day to day, often in cars and are on food stamps and welfare to get by.
That's right.
This is a humongous crisis, and we're now only at the beginning of a technological revolution, automation and artificial intelligence and this whole information complex, which will put more and more people out of work permanently, and no respect for race, religion, or ethnicity. These are the essential matters. Trump, relative to his opponents, is at least addressing these questions in some way, where the Democrats have become focused only upon getting Trump out and and high-sounding slogans with no substance.
Right. Yeah, again, there's no class-based program. And this is the, this is what I'm saying. It's a legacy of the in the last 30 years or better of politics where, I don't know, I guess maybe during the Reagan era, and Thatcher era, whatever, they dropped the last, you know, bit of that rhetorical confrontation of capitalism. You know, by the time of Clinton, you know, it was a whole different game. Where prosperity was going to make us all rich, and you know, nobody was talking about they stole our stuff. We want it back, and where's the guillotine anymore? That went out of the unions. The unions are now 10% of the workforce, if that. And not even a leading 10% of the workforce.
That's right.
Usually,
that's right.
It's the most conservative actors, and you know, among the workforce. So, unless there is some kind of so what we have in response, we see pop up in Europe, for example, Syriza, which gets elected on a radical program, comes essentially out of nowhere, and gets elected on a radical left program, which they eventually betray, and they get voted out after a few, couple of years, 4 years, I think. Podemos in Spain, and you know, similar movements across Europe. People have been in the streets in Okinawa, for example, for decades, but now it's pushing really hard. We might actually see this phenomenon that you've described a number of times as imperial retreat take place on a more than moderate scale with the demilitarization of not just Korea, but a withdrawal of the U.S. or a huge reduction of the U.S. in Japan and Okinawa, which the U.S. has been occupying Japan and Okinawa since the World War II occupation. That's a massive military operation that could be shut down tomorrow and nothing really would change in the world. And then the same room exists in Europe, of course, where they have all the military forces up against Russia's borders. If that were to be cut back by Trump, say, and or some, you know, large movement towards that, at the same time it would fuel tremendous economic growth, which he could, if he wanted to, say, this caused that, and we still have this much more that we can do. The whole mindset of the electorate could be changed, no matter how the media treated it. That's a real that's a nightmare for the elite.
And Trump's base are, you know, pushing for that. That's what they really want. That's what they voted for essentially in 2016.
Right.
An end to austerity, building of the infrastructure, and an end to these wars of intervention.
Right. Yep.
I mean, it's simple.
Yep. Peace, bread, jobs.
And land and jobs.
Yep. Yeah. Well, yeah. It's amazing, but that's what happened. And in a sense, he has already turned the Republican Party into a workers' party on that
right.
program.
Without a real working class ideology.
I would say with an anti-working class ideology,
But that's where the struggle is. But we have to understand what the architecture, the geography of the situation is.
This is the battlefield,
That's the battleground.
That's right.
You know, and that's why, you know, it's such a joke. The Democratic Party. It has become a joke. Yep. It is not a party that can seriously contest for national power. And if they continue as they are going, they will lose the House. And that's what a lot of what the so-called moderate Democrats are afraid of, as well as losing to Trump for the second time, which might seal the deal and be the end of the Democratic Party as a force in national politics.
Certainly an end to the rule of the elite that's been running the Democratic Party for the last 20, 30 years.
Thank you very much, Don.
Thank you to Professor Montero. Pleasure as always.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.